My name's Chevo. I'm an alcoholic. So I'm incredibly grateful to be here. I don't get the opportunity to be here and speak as often as I would like to. I've spent a lot of time thinking about being here and about what's important, what was important to me when I was here with Trey. And the book talks about our stories having depth and weight. And I spent a lot of time recalling many of those very, very distant memories that are way back in the past. And so I'm going to share some of those with you guys, only so that I can qualify myself and give my story depth and weight. Because if I only tell you about my story today, it is moons different from what it was back then. And so I remember as far back as I can remember, just feeling different. I know that that's kind of like the normal thing to say around here and in the rooms, but like I felt like I was the outsider in the family. I felt like I was I remember being around 4 or 5 and being at home and standing out on the porch, and my dad comes out and says, what are you doing? And I said, I'm going to run away. And my mom says, you're not going anywhere. And, you know, they get into kind of a bickering match about how to deal with the situation. And my mom takes over and says, if you want to go, go, you know. And that was kind of the way that things kind of went, where I just kind of felt like I was not really part of, even at a really young age. And not for any real identifiable reason that I can give you, other than that was just my personal inside feeling, right? And so I just kind of felt like the outsider all the damn time. There came a point in time to where, you know, when little boys do what little boys do and want to hang out with their dads, I just remember being the one that was isolated, and I needed to go inside, and I needed to go read a book, something or other. I mean, something different than was going on back then. But then as we kind of got a little bit older, by the way, I didn't add this to the story, which will be very relevant here in just a little bit. My dad was a police officer. And so as we grew up and as we got older, like in middle school and in high school age, he would bring home all those pamphlets that would just annoy me. And I see you looking at me, you're like, I'd get a pamphlet about opiates and a pamphlet about, you know, marijuana and a pamphlet. He was just fighting so hard, trying to keep us off of drugs at a very, very early age. And I remember that very vividly, to where, you know, I think, you know, maybe like in high school, we started going to parties and the alcohol would be there and it would be offered. And I would initially say no. And then there came a point in time to where that just wasn't cool anymore. And I remember hanging out with a bottle in my hand and I wasn't drinking it. And, later on, when I finally drank it, I did not drink like the other people at that place. I was the dude that was going to get carried away. I was the dude that was going to need to have some help to get home. I remember I showed up drunk at the house one time, and I went to the room. My dad was trying to talk to me, and I was just telling him that I was tired. And, of course, nobody believed it. I stunk, and he just let me go to bed. And that was kind of the beginning of my drinking, was when I finally started drinking. I just never drank like anybody, like the other people that were drinking with us in high school. I was the guy that needed to be carried away and, just drank entirely too much. And it didn't happen all the time, but when it happened, it was the binge drinking. And that was the same thing that happened once we got into college. And so the relevancy of my dad being a police officer is that as soon as I graduated from high school, I got a job at the Hays County Sheriff's Department as a jailer. And so I was 18 years old. I was a kid. The older folks would, the older people that were in jail would mess with me that I needed to be home watching cartoons and stuff like that. But, I was 18 years old, hanging out, watching people. And if you've ever been there, which I've been there both as a worker and as a person who got arrested, but if you've ever been there, when you leave the Hays County Sheriff, it's a lot like going to Del Valle, where it's kind of out in the middle of nowhere, and then as you drive into town, there's a gas station. And so every day that I would leave every day that I would go to work, I would stop at the gas station. They'd see me in my uniform. I was 18. But they'd see me in my uniform, and then I'd go to work. And then every day I'd leave work at, in the morning at 7 o'clock in the morning. I'd stop again at the gas station, grab a soda. After a while, I realized these dudes have a little respect for me. I'm going to come in before work with my pants on, without my uniform shirt on, see if I can buy some beer. And so then the guys would start selling me beer. And so I was 18, and I was the guy who could go and buy beer, and nobody ID'd me. And they just assumed that everything was great because I'd show up on the other days and go to work. And so that kind of set things off to where the binge drinking was more of a regular drinking, where I was drinking not all the time, but every weekend and pretty regularly. I got through a lot of scrapes because, you know, of my situation, where my dad was a police officer and I was working at the jail. It's not something I'm proud of, but it's something that is my reality as I look back and I realize that things could have turned out a whole lot different for me had that not been my situation. But there came a point in time where that ego, you know, I had the inferiority complex. I've talked to you guys about that already. I didn't ever feel good enough. I didn't ever feel part of. But the ego took over as well. And so there was the ego that just, I wasn't moving as far up, you know, in the chain of command as I thought I ought to be, and I wasn't important enough, and all that stuff, to where I finally just said, I don't want to do that anymore. And then I ended up graduating from college as well, and then I ended up stuck, and I said, well, what am I going to do? And I decided, well, I'm going to continue to go to school, and I ended up in law school. And I end up in law school, which I had the privilege of meeting my beautiful wife in law school. She was not going to marry me back then, but I met her back then. So I went to law school, and the drinking continued, and I finally got arrested, and I ended up in the Harris County Jail. And so, that touched y'all in a way that nothing else has so far. If you've ever been there, that's not a pleasant place. And so it took me, you know, if you know that place, it takes a little bit longer than the average place to get out. And so that was the most unpleasant thing that I have experienced in my life. And so I went home after I got out, and that was my first experience with the swearing that I was going to stop drinking. I poured out all the beer that was at the house. I, you know, swore to my friends. I remember my friends coming over and, you know, good guys that were in law, that I was in law school with, and they talked me through it, and I said, no, I'm just going to stop drinking. I'm never going to go through this, because I think I'm a relatively intelligent guy where I was using logic. I was reading the chapter about the agnostics in the big book just now, and it talks about logic, and I think I'm a pretty logical guy, and I just said, well, if I just cut this out, then I won't have this problem again. And I said, well, I'm going to pour all the beer out. I'm just not going to drink again. Everything's going to be great, right? And we'll get past this scrape, and everything's going to be cool. The problem is that if you're like me, if you're an alcoholic, you're going to end up having that itch again. And it probably took a couple of weeks where I had a couple of drinks. And I said, see, I can do it. Have a few more. See, I can do it. And then I end up trashed. And then I end up back down the road again. And then, you know, I'm just back down the road where I'm just trying to live that life again, where I'm still dealing. I remember going to court back then, dealing with that DWI, and being hung over and being in court and, you know, sweating, and that sweat that you get in the morning after, you know, drinking a bunch. And the stories can go on and on. And I can tell you guys that, you know, I ended up out of law school. I ended up getting past that DWI without having a conviction. I ended up getting licensed to be a lawyer. I ended up back in San Marcos practicing law. And it took a few years after graduating from law school. It took a few years for it to progress to the point to where I stopped. But that progression that's talks about in the big book was happening. And, you know, you can see it in the booking photos as well, the bloating that was going on, and just the features that were happening to my face as you kind of look at those booking photos as they progress. And I got out of a lot of scrapes, and I didn't get out of the last few. And that was because the progression was going on. And there comes a point in time where there's just not, incorporating a little bit of law into this, there comes a point in time where there's just not a way to identify anything other than that's a drunk guy in that video. There's an argument of fatigue and being tired and all this stuff in the early stages of the progression. But after you progress to the point to where you're drinking and driving at the point where you just can't, see straight and don't know where you're at and don't know what time it is, even close, remotely, and what city you're in, those are the times where that's just a drunk guy in that video. And so there's the last couple of times, and they, by the way, every other than that Harris County arrest happened in Hayes County, so I was in a very familiar place. And I was trying to figure it out. I was trying to figure out alcohol. I was trying to figure out liquor. I was trying to figure out who I was with. I was trying to figure out which bars I was going to. I was trying to manipulate the situation to try to figure it out. And I was trying to use my logic. And, there was all this stuff that I was trying to figure out to be able to keep drinking and for them to quit screwing with me, right? And so then the last point was, well, I'm just going to switch places of where I drink completely. And I started drinking in New Braunfels. And I started making some friends down there. And so I started hanging out with those guys. And we end up at some woman's house one night after we'd been drinking. And she had a bar. And we were drinking at her bar. And her significant other showed up. And there were three guys at her home with her significant other who showed up. And the two guys say, I was just so drunk, they tried to shove me in a truck while they were arguing with the significant other. And I don't know. That's just what happens in the progression, right? We get to the point to where we do not realize what we're doing anymore. We have those blackout phases. We're just so far gone that I just took off in the truck and left those two guys there. And so they had no choice but everybody to call the police and say, look, we got a big mess going on over at this house. This dude just took off in this other dude's truck. And here comes the cavalry, and cops are over at the house. Cops are looking for me. And I don't remember any of this, but this is what I'm told. And then, of course, then there's the video of the stop. that when the cops stop me and I pull over, which just coincidentally, I happened to pull over in the parking lot of the Comal County Probation Office. And when I open the door, I fall out. I don't step. I step out, and I must have thought it was my Tahoe. And I miss because it was a jacked up truck. And I miss, and I just tumble out and fall, and I scrape up my face. This is all on video, guys. This is miserable. And so then I go to jail for my last time. I wake up, still as belligerent as ever, look in the mirror and all scraped up. Police brutality. This kind of shit's going on. And then I had a jailer come to me and say, man, you probably ought to figure out what happened last night before you start accusing cops of brutality. And then he walked away. And then I said, well, when do I see a judge so that I can get out of this joint? And he said, well, we don't know because you've got a hold on you right now. And I said, a hold for what? Well, you're under investigation. Well, I'm here for DWI. What other hold is? Well, they're considering whether to charge you with unauthorized use of a motor vehicle because you took off in a dude's truck. And of course, I'm sitting there thinking, I've got a truck. I wouldn't take anybody's truck. What's going on? And so then the reality starts to hit. Like, not only am I here on a DWI, and I've been dealing with misdemeanors for a long time, but I'm a lawyer, and if I get hit with a felony, I got major problems, and I was already having problems already because I was picking up DWIs, right? And so I'm sitting there thinking, what's going on? What in the world is going on? And finally I get to see the judge, and I'm like, well, judge, can you tell me what's going on here? This is supposed to just be a DWI. Well, you were being investigated for UUMV because you evidently took off in somebody else's truck. And I'm still just dumbfounded. And so she finally sets a bond. I go and call my parents. They go take care of the bond. And while all that's happening, all this is processing that I just clearly have lost my shit. I've lost. There's no way to identify anymore. There's no way to logic my way out of this deal anymore. I have lost absolute control over anything that I could ever think of that I had any control over at all. I mean, I ended up in a different county in a different jail that I'd never been in, not knowing what I was there for, scraped up, accusing people of police brutality, being told that I fell out of a truck, and just absolute insanity. And so it finally hit me. Let me back up for a moment. There was a gentleman that was coming to see me who was a lawyer in town who everybody knew was sober. But I didn't want that back then. And after every time I'd get arrested, he'd come and visit me. And he was doing the 12-step thing. And I did not want that. Not happening. I'm good. I just need people to leave me alone. I got this figured out. And so whenever I'm walking out of the Comal County Jail that time, of course, everybody's got mama and a daddy. And mama and daddy are there. And my dad's first question was, are you okay? And for the first time in my life, the answer was no. And I remember crying, and I remember saying, I need help. And he says, well, it's time to go see Jim, who was the guy who was coming to see me, which I'm sure he was talking to my parents as well. So he says, it's time to go see Jim. And so we get out, and we call Jim. Jim does what Jim does and says everything's going to be okay. Hooked me up with another guy. Took me to my first AA meeting that night. And then we met the next day, and he says, I think you need to go to treatment. I said, man, I know I need help, but I need to go to treatment. You don't think a couple of these meetings that we send our clients to ain't going to work out for me? You know, we can't do that? No. I think it'd be good for you to go to treatment. And so I held out for a couple of days, and I went to go see this other guy that we trust and we were good friends with that's not an alcoholic and, you know, just a real good guy. And he says, it's time. And everything just kind of started breaking down in front of me. Where everybody around me who I trusted for their logic and their brilliance and their intelligence and all that stuff, just everybody was looking at me and saying, it's time. And so I brought my dad, and we visited some treatment centers. We came out here because this is really close to home. I was born in Lockhart. My mom and dad live in Kyle. And we came out here, and then like true loving Al-Anons that need more Al-Anon, my dad comes out here and says, I know you need help, but do you really need all this? And by that time, I was convinced. I said, yeah, I need it. I was still healing up from from the scrapes on my face. And so I checked in here on December the 16th of 2006. My last drink was on December the 10th of 2006. And we spent, Trey was my roommate. And we spent Christmas, New Year's. My birthday's on January 7th. I spent my birthday here. And I spent a lot of time reading that big book that made no sense to me whatsoever. I sat if the dining room is still here where everybody goes together, or back then there were no females on this campus, but the dining room was right here. And so all the extra time that we would have, the guys would be out here working out and playing ball and stuff like that. And I was reading this book because I just thought that I could figure this out, right? I was still the logic dude, and I did not understand the book. And so it finally took this idea of a sponsor, this idea of another man who was going to walk me through the steps, and this idea that this another man that was going to love me enough, right, to talk me through a lot of the things that I had never wanted to talk to other people about. And then I started opening up to people like Mike Falls was a guy who used to be out here back in the day. And I remember sharing with him many of the things that I did not want to share with any other man. And he looked at me and he says, I love you and God loves you. And I never understood that, because I grew up with a God who punished, a God who was going to punish you for your bad deeds. I grew up with a God who was constantly watching over you, hovering you, waiting and ready to zap you when he was ready. And I just shared all this bad stuff. And it just did not make any sense to me. And so I finally surrounded myself with men who started introducing me to a God who was a loving God, who loved me no matter what, who loved me no matter what I did in the past, no matter who I thought I was presently, and no matter what I would go through in the future. And that was a remarkable thing to me, because when I walked into these rooms, I had listened to my dad saying, turn to God, God's going to help you. And I'd go to church and I'd say, man, those people are judgmental. I don't want to go there anymore. Those people are sitting there looking at me knowing that I got to go out in the car and blow in the car before the car will turn on so I can leave church. And they're judging me. I don't want to be here. And every time I would show up there, and the first time I showed up in an AA room, everybody gave me hugs. And everybody welcomed me. And everybody asked me to come back. And it was the strangest thing in the world. And so I started spending time with Jim, and so we made commitments, and we walked through some very basic things, like he would go to a meeting with me 3 times a week. There were certain places that he would be at, and if I would go, I was welcome to be with him. We would go to lunch 1 time a week, and we would go to dinner before 1 meeting each week. And that was our deal, and we would walk through the steps. And it was about 9 months into it before I woke up one day and I walked out of the house, and I remember smelling the dew in the fall on the grass. I remember walking out and smelling that dew, that smell that in the mornings when the dew kind of forms on the grass and you can smell it and you know it's football season. And I smelt it, and I remember walking out and feeling everything's going to be okay. I'd spent a few months inside my home, very, very depressed, very, very lost. And I was spending that time with another man who loved me enough to walk me through the steps. And I started to feel fulfilled. I started to feel like there actually was a loving God that existed, because I only knew one that was a punishing God. And so I started to feel that. And that wasn't something that happened overnight. That wasn't something that happened like I read the book and then here it was and everything was wonderful. That was something that I felt over time. And then I started spending time with other men, and I started sharing that same story with them. And my life started to change before my eyes. My dad started to trust me again. He started to trust me with taking care of family matters that he would not have trusted me with before. I started going out and making amends. And one of the ways that my wife and I reconnected was, I had some things that I wanted to clear up with her, and I needed to make amends. And I remember I was living here in San Marcos, and we made plans to go to a baseball game, and I went to go see her. There's a really huge idea about perceived wrongs, right? We got to clean up things that, even though that we may think, man, I didn't do anything wrong in that situation. I don't think I did. But if the other person perceives it as having been wrong, there's a huge thing about that. And I wanted to go clear those things up, and I wanted to be right. And I went, and I spent some time with her. And so we started to spend time again as friends, and we reconnected. And the miracles that are all laid out in the book were already happening, and those miracles started to happen as well. And there's a beautiful young boy over there that's about to be 5 and who is watching his iPad or playing it with the strings, but that's one of the miracles that comes out of this program. And today, I'm sure that you guys are like, wow, that's a lawyer up there who is a drunk and who was actively a drunk and was going to court representing people. I want to share that with you guys as well, is that there came a point in time, and I love our justice system because it also protects people from me whenever that's a necessary item as well, is... there came a point in time where in my early career that I was taking court appointments that I was no longer even qualified to take court appointments. That means I was no longer qualified to represent people for free because I was just so far gone. And so judges had removed me from having the ability to represent people on a court-appointed basis and had put me on a mentorship program to make sure that when I did come to court that I was not intoxicated. I'd like to say, you know, part of this is ego, but part of this is just the reality of the situation is that I remember initially having to argue about that because even, I hate this, I mean, it's partly ego, but it's just, I believe I am a good lawyer, and back then I had to argue about it, and they said, it's just not acceptable, and we're not going to accept it. Today, looking back 11 years later, I realize that that's not acceptable. In the mindset that we have, that people just got to quit messing with us, that seemed acceptable to me at the time, though. But I'm grateful today that the justice system is smart enough to protect others from people like me when I was in that state. You got me? And so now I can tell you that my life has progressed to the point to where I regained those abilities to do that. I gained the trust of many, many people along the way. Those people have since referred me all of their friends and family. My business has grown to a point of having that trust, not only because of the good work that I do, but because of me sharing my story with others and being open about it and sharing my story of God's love and how he has changed my life through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and has restored all those relationships that I had lost there for a while and that were stripped from me. And today I no longer have to worry about whether or not I'm on a court-appointed list. I never longer have to take court-appointed cases. I can now look at cases and choose cases that I believe in. We represent people who are in prison, who we believe to be innocent. We represent people who have been wronged. You know, when I say we, I say me and my wife now. We represent people who have been, you know, wronged in different ways and who need the justice system to work in their favor, who have no money, but need good lawyers. You know, all these things have progressed to the point to where when I was drinking and I was angry and I was frustrated and I had all those resentments that I wasn't getting my keep, I'm now getting it, but it's through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Am I making that point? I'm struggling because I'm trying to make sure that I'm making that clear. Everything that I thought, my ego thought, that I deserved, everything that I thought I was supposed to be getting when I was angry at a bar stool and I was drinking and I was pissed off at the world, that I wasn't getting it. They just didn't know me, right? I was speaking that language. You don't know me. You don't know that I can do what all these other people were doing. Angry at a freaking bar stool, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and Austin Recovery have brought me to a point to where over a period of 11 to 12 years, I've now gotten to the point to where I'm accomplishing everything, every dream that I had ever had back then, every thought that I had ever thought of what I deserved, I'm now getting it. But that's through loving God that I was introduced to through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You got me? It looks like I'm going to give you guys a few minutes back. I am incredibly grateful to be here. I'm incredibly grateful for my sobriety. There's nothing that I would change about my life today. I wouldn't take back any of those bad experiences that I've experienced. I wouldn't take back any of the recovery that I've been through. My sponsor died 5 years ago. He left me with some of the strangest things will happen in your sobriety that I look back on, and I just, man, he was such a brilliant, beautiful man. He had a first edition big book that he had bought early in his sobriety, and a year before he passed, he had me over for my birthday, and he wanted to wish me happy birthday, and he said, man, I'm getting rid of some of my stuff because I don't want my family to have to deal with all the junk that I've collected over the years when I pass, and I remember sitting there saying, Jim, you know, you're going to be with us for a long time, brother. You know, nothing's going to happen to you. And he said, I want you to have this. These are some of the things that I cherish today and that I'll pass on to my child or somebody who was like a child to me, like I was to him in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I pray that each of you have the same profound and deep relationships in this program, the same way that I have had the benefit of having, and get to experience the love of a beautiful and loving God the same way that I have experienced him through the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's the only way that I would have ever experienced a loving God and understood a loving God, is that through the people that are here, through the people that loved me anyway, right? And so I hope that my story is giving you guys just a little bit of hope, and I really do appreciate you guys letting me share today.